This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Unless you live in a cave somewhere up in the Arctic Circle, or you're adept at ignoring political small talk along with all forms of media, including radio, TV, the internet, and all those robocalls, chances are you know that next Tuesday is Election Day.
But awareness and action are two different things. And the question remains, who and how many people will actually vote next week? In a country founded on governance by the people and for the people, how is it possible that nearly half of eligible voters in the U.S. don't vote?
Errol Morris took a crack at that question recently. The Academy Award-winning filmmaker who lives in Cambridge produced a short film that posed that and other questions to a group of young Americans. Here's a sampling of some of their answers about why not to vote.
No candidate is good. Everyone's telling lies
over what to believe and what to think.
I'm in this state, and it always goes this way.
Bipartisan thing. Blue or red, regardless of what I do.
It's complex.
It's like buying a ticket to the movie. Here's the next election.
A wasteland with smog everywhere and dead birds falling out of the sky.
Or a couple hanging chads.
It's just a way of making yourself happy.
But you don't think it is?
No.
As that one guy said, it's complex. The reasons behind voter apathy are many, and they lead to all kinds of questions about our voting system. For instance, how to encourage more people to vote, or making voting easier. Many states have early voting. Is that a good idea? What about absentee ballots, or making voting mandatory? And what about that contentious debate over voter ID?
And while we're on the subject, why do we vote on the first Tuesday of November anyway? Well, we've got two experts who know a lot about these questions. Professor Alex Kasar is with us in the studio. He's the Sterling Professor of History and Social Policy at the Kennedy School of Government. And Alex Kasar, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us from New York is Jamie Chandler. He's a political scientist at Hunter College. And Jamie, thanks so much for coming in today as well. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. With less than a week to go until Election Day, what's your question about voting? If you're an eligible voter who's not planning to vote, tell us why. If you could create your ideal voting system, what would it look like? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Jamie Chandler, let me begin with you and with a little bit of history. Many of us have asked while waiting in line at the polls on our lunch breaks, why do we vote on Tuesday, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November?
Well, it's actually kind of a misperception that's out there in the press about why we vote on Tuesday. The question has come up over the past couple of days with the storm and how the country's going to respond to any potential of power outages that are plaguing the Northeast. But the Tuesday voting tradition came about in 1792. There was a law passed by Congress that said that the election had to take place within 34 days of the Electoral College voters being appointed, which would be the Tuesday following the first Monday in November. And then that changed in 1845. There was a law passed that created a uniform voting day of Tuesday after the first Monday. So what that does is it leaves exactly 34 days until the Electoral College votes. If your listeners aren't familiar, the way our presidential election system works is that we vote in our states. Whoever wins the popular vote in the state will win the electoral votes allocated to that state, which is the number of House of Representative members that your state has plus your two senators. And then on December 3rd, the Electoral College voters who have been chosen either by vote by the public or by your state legislatures will actually officially make the presidential election ballot. So we have this tradition now, which is basically stuck since 1845, of having the election on the Tuesday that we have it on. But, you know, there's been changes over time. I mean, early voting, which came about as in 2002, now allows people to vote up to several weeks before the actual election.
And we're going to talk about all that. But Alex Kasar, let me ask you, this Tuesday voting day, does it still make sense? It sounds a bit like a vestige from another time.
It is a vestige from another time. I mean, Tuesday was chosen for reasons particular to the society of the 1840s. And it makes very little sense in the modern world. And one indication of that is, as far as I know, there is no other country in the world which holds elections on Tuesdays.
And we've made a number of attempts to actually change it, right?
There has been a lot of thought given to it. The most recent a serious attempt with respect to federal elections came in the wake of the Carter Ford Commission after the celebrated 2000 election. And the Carter Ford Commission recommended that the election be held on Veterans Day. There was also some support for Sunday voting, which is very common in elsewhere in the world, but the violation of the Sabbath seemed to be a little too severe for us. But Veterans Day was recommended, but Congress had relatively little interest in that, and veterans groups came out against it, which I personally found peculiar, but they did.
Jamie Chandler, we mentioned that over the past many election cycles, on average, about half of all eligible voters don't vote. How does that compare to the rest of the developed democracies around the world?
Well, it's about the voting turnout is about on average. It depends on the particular election season. Sometimes, you know, voter turnout has been going up since 1996. The 2008 election saw the national average at 61%. But it compares relatively the same to the rest of the developed world. And the reason for this is that we see historically a trend where the more mature your democracy is, the less interested some of your voter population is in voting.
That's so interesting, and that sounds counterintuitive. What are the reasons for that?
Well, it depends on a lot of things. I mean, largely the excitement of a democracy tends to wear off over time, so that people lose the sense of the tradition. I mean, when you look at new democracies, like in the early 90s when some of the Eastern European countries had their first elections, voter turnout was very high, 95 to 99%. And even those countries have now been falling off over time. So the biggest problem is that if you do a cost-benefit analysis on voting, and I think one of your interviewees mentioned this, is that the benefit for voting really is to experience your feeling of civic pride.
Sure.
There's no more benefit of that, but the costs of actually voting are much higher. You have to learn about the candidates, and you have to actually get to the polling station. So I think that's one of the problems that needs to be addressed in reforming the voting system.
And let's talk a little bit about that. But Alex Kesar, you wanted to comment about this falling off of excitement, I guess, about the opportunity to vote.
Yeah, I think I respectfully disagree with that. I'm not sure that there is such a thing as a mature versus immature democracy. And the fact is that most Western countries, until quite recently, had turnout rates that were significantly higher than ours. And I think that one place to look for a cause of the decline in turnout is a narrowing of the differences between the parties and thus a sort of an absence of perceived choice among voters. That's something which has been true in the United States for quite a long time. Even though in this election, I think we probably rightly are seeing very severe differences between the two parties, but on a very broad spectrum, the options offered to the American people have been quite narrow. And related to that, an important point is that turnout is not low in all socioeconomic groups. Turnout is low among people who are relatively poor and relatively uneducated. Hmm. Turnout among people with college degrees is in the high 70 percentiles.
Well,
yeah,
I
agree with that. I mean, I think there's definitely a number of different dimensions of voter turnout, which I wanted to talk about at some point today. But, you know, if we look at the Western democracies, one of your colleagues at Harvard wrote a book about this on Robert Putnam. There has been a longer-term trend where we've seen in many of these European and U.S. democracies where the sense of civic republicanism, or what's called social capital, volunteering, participating in politics, has been on a decline since the 1960s. And our turnout rate in the U.S. took a big nosedive after 68. One of the problems was the distrust in government over Vietnam and the social movements and so forth. Now, it's gone up since 96, right? And, you know, part of voting, not voting, is the fact that voters think that there's not much difference in the parties or the candidates, but a lot of things have been done since 96 to try to encourage voters to actually turn out.
Well, let's take a couple of calls from listeners. We've got a lot of people already on the line who want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to Matt, who's calling from Waltham. Hi, Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking the call. I want to come back to the issue of having a national election day as a day off from work and a holiday. And I think so much about the holidays that we have, particularly holidays like Columbus Day. And I wonder why we don't have election day on either a weekend or a national holiday. And actually, I'll just tell you quickly, part of the thought came from I lived in Lima, Peru during their national elections. And they have elections on a Sunday, and I just to address one of the speaker's points about it being the Sabbath, this is a Catholic country, that they have election day on a Sunday. It's mandatory, and they also ban the sale of alcohol for 48 hours prior to their elections. So the question just is, why don't we have a national election day as a holiday?
It's a great question. I'm also intrigued by this idea of a mandatory voting, which some countries have. Alex Kesar, let me start with you and your response to Matt.
Well, I agree with Matt. I think we should have some kind of national holiday. I think, it's always hard to prove why you don't have something. But I think that if you look at the record, it's difficult not to conclude that the two major parties may be less interested than many of us are in maximizing turnout. They are interested in winning elections and having a recognizable electorate because they have resisted. In recent years, it's been particularly the Republicans, but this is not a purely partisan issue. They have resisted the kinds of reforms that might encourage greater participation.
Can you give us a case in point there or an example of what you're talking about?
For example, making it easier, various devices to make it easier to register. The initial vetoing of the Motor Voter Bill, the National Voter Registration Act, which is first passed under the first President Bush, and then was finally signed by President Clinton. But may I tell you an interesting story about Massachusetts and mandatory voting?
Please.
Massachusetts actually passed enabling legislation in the early 20th century, I think a constitutional clause. To make it possible for the legislature to make voting mandatory. This was at a point when many people believed that the problem with our electoral system was that immigrants and workers and poor people were voting in very high numbers and respectable good folks were not showing up. So they decided to make voting, they thought about making voting mandatory. Then the very first studies were done which in fact established that the opposite was true, that respectable, good, middle-class folks showed up, poor people and immigrants did not show up, and then the view of mandatory voting was, never mind.
Well, speaking of mandatory voting, I want to go back to that film from Errol Morris. And by the way, listeners, you can see this film. There's a link to it at radioboston.org. He has a moment in this brief film where he talks about mandatory voting. Let's listen.
I think you should be able to get paid to vote the way you get paid for jury duty.
For instance, in Peru, you get fined if you don't vote.
They should be sent to Antarctica.
What about tasering people to get them to vote?
That's a little bit too far.
Okay, so that question that you heard, what about tasering, that came from filmmaker Errol Morris. Jamie Chandler, obviously no one is going to talk about tasering people for not voting, but what about the idea of mandatory voting? This is something that came up in our discussion on our staff just this morning. They do it in, that we heard, they do it in Peru, they do it in Australia, they do it all over the world. Good idea for the U.S.?
Well, the movement, the kind of like a more modern movement for compulsory voting, which is the term that's used in political science circles, has really been kind of ebbing and flowing over the past several years. Basically, what it would do is it would offset the cost benefits that I mentioned earlier. So now the cost of not voting is that you get a fine, right? So the cost is, I'm sorry, the benefit then becomes is that you don't have to pay the fine. But from a political culture standpoint in the United States, it's probably very unlikely that we would have a compulsory voting system because people perceive the vote as a right versus a duty.
Hmm.
Right?
Hmm.
You also have a sentiment of negativity towards jury duty, which would play a role. Now, I just want to go back to the point that the professor made about the partisan nature of bringing about reforms like this, like compulsory voting and holidays. There is a partisan tilt. Basically, Democrats are more likely to support expanding the voting franchise, right, or making it easier for people to vote. And Republicans are less likely to do that, and it's the nature of their membership base, right? The Democrats actually have a advantage in the population in terms of people who say they're Democrat, right? Now, they don't have an advantage in terms of the number of Democrats who turn out. Republicans have a more homogeneous membership base, and their voters are somewhat smaller. So the Republicans want to ensure that they don't advantage the Democrats if, in fact, we had these things like a holiday. Now, holiday has come up hundreds of times in Congress over the past several years, and it always ends up dying in some kind of committee or what have you, instead of moving forward.
Hmm. Alex Kasar, you've written a lot about sort of systematic efforts to suppress voter participation, which I'm reminded of by Jamie Chandler's comments. What's the brief report card about sort of where we stand on that today?
Well, the brief report card is that some efforts at voter suppression in the recent history have succeeded or on the books. There are a number of states which have more stringent photo ID laws than they had 2 years ago or 10 years ago. There are some states which have shortened their early voting periods. And there are some states where third-party registration groups found it more difficult. Are these efforts at a point where they might have a major impact on this election? The simple answer is we don't know. I certainly don't know. I think it's probably unlikely, but laws have been passed that are going to make that either now or in the future, if they remain on the books, are going to make it more difficult for basically for poor people, poor young people and poor elderly people to cast ballots.
Mm. Let's take another call. Ed Cook is calling from Waltham. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm actually not calling from Waltham, but I'm a history teacher in a public high school in the suburb of Boston. I just got out of school, and I just wanted to throw in a sort of a positive note. I teach U.S. history and U.S. government, and this year, and I teach a population of students who are largely from disadvantaged homes, and many of the kids in our part of the school are have dropped out or were going to drop out, and I've helped 25 or 26 kids get registered to vote, and I've spent a lot of time explaining the voting process to them and encouraging them to watch the debates and so forth, and their response has been remarkable. I've been very encouraged. Their reports and ideas after watching the debates were as deep and interesting as any of the hired talking heads, as they say.
Ed, you've put a great point on the table, and I'm really glad for your call. Jamie, talk a little bit about that. I mean, it seems like one of the really important elements here that's missing or that we could do a better job at is with better civic education in our schools and essentially preparing people to be better voters.
Exactly. I mean, one of the downfalls of the these economic crises, 1970s and the 2000s, is that on the state level, there have been pushes to limit the budgets, limit school budgets. In Massachusetts, for example, in the late 70s, early 80s, Proposition 2.5 was passed, which put limits on school budgets. So what we see is that we see less efforts to do civic education classes and so forth. They're not as ubiquitous. I mean, the better school systems tend to have more civic education options than the poor neighborhoods. So if we did have an expansion of civic education, we would see some bump in voter turnout or at least some knowledge, more interest in politics. It's not going to be some kind of panacea, solve the problem, but it would help helping make it better.
Let me go back to another brief clip from that film by Errol Morris and introduce another idea. It's an argument about why we should vote because every vote counts. Let's listen.
I was living in England in 2000 and didn't get in my registration in time, so I didn't vote in Florida in 2000. So I'm very aware that my vote counts and will be spending the rest of my life making up for that.
Did something happen in Florida in 2000?
Yeah, a little something happened.
So, of course, the 2000 election came down to just 530 votes in Florida, so every vote might count. But that's not really true now? I mean, they may have counted in Florida in 2000. They may count next week in Ohio. But it seems like one of the challenges we have is most people don't feel that their vote matters that much in most of the states, especially in a presidential election. How do we respond to that one, Alex Kazar?
Well, I would be happy to respond by abolishing the Electoral College and having a national popular vote. I mean, just imagine really what the kind of mobilization that you would be seeing in these weeks with an election this close and so much apparently at stake if this were a national election. I mean, right now, instead, for most of us, we go home in the evening and watch what's going on in Ohio, Florida, and Virginia. It is a real damper on, and it's not just on a particular act of voting in a particular year. It seems to me that getting involved in a campaign, especially for young people, getting mobilized, going out there, is part of a lifelong educational process that will make you more likely to be engaged in the future as well. And we lose that cycle after cycle.
Jamie Chandler, your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Getting rid of the Electoral College is one component of why people perceive that their vote doesn't count. I mean, you look at states like New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts. Those states are inherently going to go Democrat. So Republican voters in those states don't have an incentive to go out and vote. The problem with getting rid of the Electoral College is that the Electoral College actually helps make campaigning efficient, because it's much more easy for the candidates to strategically allocate their resources around the country to mobilize voters. And underlying that, the reason why many of these states have these, you know, single-party holds on their state governments, which contribute to this problem where one party doesn't feel like their vote counts, is through a process called redistricting when the congressional districts are drawn up. Right, so we have to make some reforms on a number of different levels in order to really start to improve the system. Now, getting rid of the Electoral College has been proposed roughly 700 times in the past 200 years, and that's probably another thing that won't get changed. Now, some states have chosen to proportionally allocate their electoral votes. Colorado had Maine. Nebraska do that, and that could be one solution or a workaround around this, but there isn't really even a movement for that.
Well, it's a big question. I know that it certainly is on a lot of voters' minds. We heard a reference to that 2000 election. I know it came up then when we actually had the winner of the popular vote not going into the White House. Big questions, a lot more we left on the table. Election Day is just six days away. I guess we can all agree the message is vote. It's important. Professor Alex Kazar, the Sterling Professor of History and Social Policy at the Kennedy School of Government, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Jamie Chandler, political scientist at Hunter College, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us, listeners. Coming up, we talk sports with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield, plus singer-songwriter Mika Pauly joins us live in our studio. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.